This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
One of the very faithful chaplains here at Whitworth, there's been a long legacy of them, is Ron Fraze. And during the 1980s, Ron was chaplain here. Ron was dean of the Institute of Ministry. Ron walked in this morning with a brochure from the 1988 WIM, and when we opened up to the middle page, there was a picture of Walter Brueggemann. Walter, it's taken us 27 years to invite you back, and we're glad you've come. So we regret the long delay, so we are glad to have you here. So the rhythm of each day is that we will begin with morning prayers at 8:45, and then at 9 o'clock, we'll have some time to reflect on the scriptures as we think about how the gospel really helps us give insight and wisdom as we navigate the troubled waters of culture. We're not the first folks that have been in the kind of the mess that many of us are feeling. It's all over the Bible as well. And so Walter's chosen four texts from the Old Testament to walk through with us each morning. That the passage for the day will be distributed on a piece of paper so you can take notes there. And we are absolutely thrilled to have Walter here. Walter has written over 90 books, and he's promised that during this week, two or three more will be completed at a discount for those of you who are attending WIM. Walter, your writing deeply influenced me as I was doing my doctoral work and thinking about the relationship between Old and New Testament, particularly your work on the biblical theme of shalom. So I want to extend a personal word of gratitude to you. We spoke about that yesterday over lunch. Walter has a delightful sense of humor. I'm just going to tell you one little story about that that I was able to witness personally. So years ago, I attended a Society of Biblical Literature meeting. I can't remember exactly where it was. And this is a gathering of Bible scholars, and all kinds of people are invited, including graduate students. And so there was a series of presentations being given on Old Testament themes, and one of the presenters was an Old Testament student, and this person got up and decided that he was going to take 45 minutes to explain why all of Walter Brueggemann's work really didn't hold water scholastically. And he kept using the phrase over and over again as he would outline some of Walter's work and then show why it was wrong. Can you believe that Walter thinks that way? And so he finishes his lecture, and he says, "So Walter Brueggemann, I've just got one question to ask. How in the world could you think that way?" The student didn't know that Walter was in the room. Several of us did, saw you sitting near the back corner. And so the student then said, "Does anybody have any questions?" And you raised your hand, and he was foolish enough to call on you first, not knowing who you were. And I will never forget what happened in that moment. You stood up and you graciously said, "Well, I'm Walter Brueggemann, and I'll be happy to explain to you exactly how I think that way." At which point, you took over the seminar and gave a profound explanation of how the scriptures give us an incredible narrative of God's faithfulness, and that's the story that we have to tell. So, Walter, we are grateful that you're here. Please welcome Walter Brueggemann.
Well, it's a very great privilege to get to be with you, and I'm glad to be with Terry, who is uncommonly generous and thoughtful. And I am particularly glad to be here when Ann and Andy are here, because I will be much instructed by both of them, and I'm very excited about being here. Is that better? Can you hear me now? An Old Testament teacher has to talk about Egypt. And I listened carefully to Anne last night, and I understood what she said. So I want to assure you that I think Egypt in the Old Testament is not a place. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for a greedy economy that can happen anywhere. And I believe that the Exodus narrative is not so much an historical memory as it is a script that is waiting to be reperformed. It is continually being reperformed, and is being reperformed in front of our very eyes. And as you know, we do not know Pharaoh's name in the Old Testament. It could have been Merneptah, or it could have been Ramses II, or it could have been none of them. And the reason we don't know Pharaoh's name is that all pharaohs act alike. So you may name Pharaoh any way you want to, because Pharaoh is essentially a system. And what I want to talk about is the power of the system and the capacity to reconstruct the system. And in any case, as you may know, and Anne certainly does, at the end of Isaiah 19, the prophet says, "Behold, the days are coming when Egypt and Assyria," that's, I guess, Iran, "will worship together, and the Lord will say, 'Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance.'" What the prophet has done is to take three pet names for Israel and assign them to Israel's enemies in anticipation that Israel's enemies will also be God's chosen peoples. It's enough to give you goosebumps. So what I've done for these 4 days is to pick out four texts that interested me, that I hope will interest you, and I hope will be of some use to you. And since I thought for a Bible study you got to have a text, and I know all of you own Bibles, and some of you even have them with you, but I thought some of you wouldn't, so I thought it would make a common thing. Does everybody have a copy of this text? So I want to just call your attention to this text quickly. It begins in 15:20-21 with dancing, because they finally were emancipated from Pharaoh's predatory system. Then they said, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God I'm mighty free at last." But alas, in verse 22, they found themselves in the wilderness with no water. As you know, if you don't have any water, you're going to die. And then in verse 26, this is amazing. God says, "I will not bring upon you any of the diseases of the Egyptians, for I am Yahweh, your doctor." Now, if you look at the commentaries, there's great scientific speculation about what the diseases of Israel are. And there's all kind of bacteriology and I don't know what all. But I suspect the diseases of Egypt are greed and anxiety. And God is our doctor. And in 16:3, that's the verse I want you to think about. It's 16:3, they bitch. Is it okay to say that here? They bitch a lot. And they are unhappy about their emancipation, and they want to go back. So I imagine in 16:3, Israel is on this precipice of deciding whether to fall back or go forward. So stand up for a minute. Stand up. and imagine yourself, go like this, on this precipice, and you are deciding whether to fall back or to go forward. You can sit down now. I want you to think about that pivot point, because I believe it is the pivot point now of the church, and I think it is the pivot point of the American economy. Something very, in the whole political process, the Donald notwithstanding, something very important is happening to our political culture, and we can fall out either way. So behind 16:3 is the history of Pharaoh. In front of 16:3 is the future of Yahweh. And I'm going to talk about those. Maybe you wondered how I'd make this little text last 50 minutes. That's how I'm going to do that. So behind 16:3 is the memory of Pharaoh that they misremember. They remember the flesh pots. That's very strange. There was no mention of flesh pots and how well they ate back there. But Pharaoh's story, I'll trace this out in five moments. You know that in the book of Genesis, Pharaoh had everything. We first meet him in chapter 12 when Abraham and Sarah went down there in a famine because Pharaoh had lots of food. But in chapter 41, Genesis, he has two nightmares. And I've been wondering, do the people with the most have the worst nightmares? And he couldn't figure out what his dreams meant, so like we've been doing forever with Freud, we have to go to a Jew to find out what our dreams mean. And Joseph said to him, you are anxious about running out. You are dreaming scarcity. I think you will find it to be correct that the people with the most have the worst nightmares about scarcity. So Pharaoh says to Joseph, what do you think I ought to do? And Joseph says, you ought to appoint a food czar. And Pharaoh says, you got any nominations? He says, how about me? So Joseph, son of Abraham, is co-opted for the scarcity system. We don't read that much in church that Joseph is a big sellout. And then when you read in chapter 47, I don't know whether you read chapter 47. We never read that in my church tradition. But it says that Pharaoh had a monopoly of, had appointed Joseph to accumulate food until he had a monopoly, so that when the peasants needed food in the monopoly, they came to Joseph and he sold them food. It didn't occur to him to give them food. And the second year when they came for food, they didn't have any money. So he took their cattle, he took their means of production and put them out of business. And the third year when they came for food, they didn't have any money and they didn't have any cattle. He took their land and he took their bodies and he made them slaves. And they said, thank you so much for making us your slaves. We are so grateful to you. So when we read the book of Exodus, we don't often wonder, how did the children get into slavery? They got into slavery by debts that they could not pay. Sound like Greece, for God's sake. And then if you read read the first chapter of the book of Exodus, which is only 2 pages away from Genesis 47, the first paragraph says that Israel became slaves because the regime needs cheap labor, and the Egyptians treated the Israelite slaves harshly and imposed unbearable production schedules on them. So the story of Pharaoh is anxiety, scarcity, accumulation, monopoly, violence. Does that sound contemporary? Anxiety, scarcity, accumulation, monopoly, violence. So we live in a predatory economy in which the money is more and more centralized and concentrated in an oligarchy that depends on cheap labor, and the credit laws are written and designed to keep cheap labor forever in debt. So we have to learn to read the Bible with more capacity for social analysis. This is not a pious little tale. This is a critique of a predatory economy. And the news of the Exodus narrative is that the totalism, go like this, the totalism, the totality, totalitarianism of the system contains everything. There is nothing doable or imaginable outside of it. And when we are seduced in our religion, we imagine that the totalism even contains what can be said about the good news of the gospel that is kept safely inside the predatory economy. In my church tradition, pastors are well paid to keep the gospel inside the predatory economy. And if you do other than that, somebody going out of church will say, "Why don't you stick with religion and talk about something you know about?" Has that ever happened to you? If it hasn't happened to you yet, you might want to ask, why not? So the news is that the totalism has been interrupted. The first words of Jesus, we think in Mark 1, he said, "The kingdom of God is at hand," which means the kingdom of Rome, with its tax collecting apparatus, had reached its end. Believe the good news. So the totalism has been interrupted by two surreptitious women, these midwives, Shifra and Puah, who dared to defy Exodus, Pharaoh, because the force was with them. And it's astonishing that we know their name. We don't know Pharaoh's name. We know the name of these two midwives. That's their 3 minutes of fame. And we left. The totalism of Pharaoh has been broken by the ferocious confrontation of Moses, who in his rage at the abuse of a Hebrew slave rose up and killed an Egyptian Pharaoh. I wouldn't be advocating violence, I wouldn't be advocating murder, but I would be advocating confrontational street action among the faithful, because Pharaoh will not yield otherwise. So the totalism has been broken and we left. The totalism has been broken by the cries of the peasants at the end of chapter 2. We groaned and cried out. We didn't cry out to anyone, we just cried out. We brought our pain to speech. Pharaoh did not care if the slaves suffered, as long as they suffered in silence. Because when vulnerable people suffer out loud, it becomes dangerous, which is why every totalitarian regime has a law against illegal assembling. Because people assembled become political energy. So the cry of the slaves attracted the God of emancipatory compassion. And God heard, and God saw, and God knew, and God remembered the book of Genesis, for God's sake. Because this God is a textual guy. So the totalism has been broken, and we left. The totalism has been broken. God came late to the Exodus narrative. God doesn't appear until chapter 3 in response to the cries. I was taught in seminary that God takes all initiatives, but Augustine must not have read the book of Exodus, because the initiative is taken by the slaves in their suffering, who in fact summon Yahweh. So the burning bush. And what happens is that this holy, awesome God signs on in alliance with the cries of the slaves, which is what produced the mantra of God's preferential option for the poor. And God, with some bombast, says, "I have seen your affliction. I know your suffering. I have come down. I will deliver you. I will take you to a land of flowing with milk, and I will do that." So the totalism has been interrupted and we left. The totalism has been interrupted because in 3:10, after 3:7-9, which Yahweh has a lot to say about what Yahweh will do, after Yahweh uses all these first-person pronouns, then Yahweh says in verse 10, you go to Pharaoh. I'm not going to Pharaoh. You go to Pharaoh. So the totalism has been broken by the designation of human agency. And the story is performed by this Moses and this Aaron, who do not travel alone, but who must be out front in their courage and in their insistence and in their resilience. So the totalism has been broken by human agency. I don't know whether those are the best five ways to break the totalism, but they're good, five good ways that are deeply set in our tradition of these surreptitious women, this violent confrontation, this bringing pain to speech, this summoning of the Holy God and this acceptance of human responsibility for the act of emancipation. It is the package. So the way in which Pharaoh is neutralized and rendered harmless is by this slow narrative undressing of Pharaoh. And you can see in the plague narratives, verse by verse and chapter by chapter, that Pharaoh is slowly being dismantled. So you can watch while his crown comes off, and you can watch while his scepter is taken away from him. You can watch while his robes are torn. You can watch until you arrive at the end, and the word is that the emperor has no clothes, the emperor has no authority, the emperor has no power. You don't have to be afraid of Pharaoh and his predatory system. So it's not abrupt. It's not quick. It's slow and teasing and dramatic. As the God of emancipation takes on more and more narrative energy, and the head of the predatory system consistently loses ground. So you can see Pharaoh coming to the recognition that he's got to negotiate. Pharaohs don't negotiate, but you got to negotiate when you run into the force of emancipation that is initiated by the God of all history. So in chapter 8, he says, well, okay, you can worship your God, but you have to do it inside the territory. And Moses said, oh, that would upset you if we did. We're not going to worship inside your territory. We would have to go outside so that we don't offend you. And then in chapter 10, Pharaoh says, well, I'm going to let you go worship. But not all of you. I'm going to keep some hostage. I think I'll keep your children. And Moses said, no, we ain't going until we all go. And later on in chapter 10, Pharaoh says, well, you can all go, but you got to leave your herds and your flocks. You got to leave your source of income. And Moses says, no, we're going to take every hoof when we go. That's a good sermon. We're going to take every hoof. This is like Nelson Mandela on Robben's Island. I ain't going until we all go. And when we go, we're all going to go. And so Pharaoh winds down into irrelevance while the movement of God's emancipation grows bigger and bigger until at the end of the 10th plague, with that wretched darkness that killed all the firstborn in Egypt, the last thing that Pharaoh gets to say in chapter 12 is, please leave. Take your flocks, take your herds, take your wives, take your children, and go. But before you go, these are his last words, bless me. So dramatically and narratively, Pharaoh had come to see that the emancipated slaves are the carriers of God's blessing, which means Pharaoh also understood that he has no longer any power to bless. And I think that acknowledgement on Pharaoh's part is not unlike the centurion late Friday night who came to the awareness, this is the guy that we have executed, but he is the wave of the future. So they leave, and the women dance. They do not for a long time, I think they do not for a long time turn their back on Egypt. I think they are backing into the wilderness because they can still see the big storehouses and the pyramids and the glory of Pharaoh. And you say, Pharaoh's got all the jobs. Pharaoh's got all the money. I don't know what we're going to do. And it took a long time for them to face the wilderness. There are two things about the wilderness that seem to me to be important. The first one is that the wonder of the wilderness is that it is beyond the reach of Pharaoh. Pharaoh does not govern the wilderness. It is a zone of freedom. But the downside is that the wilderness is a place that has no viable life support systems. That's why in 16:3, they took three steps into chapter 16. And they said, no. It's too dangerous. It's too scary. It's too risky. So they're thinking about, it wasn't so bad being dependent on Pharaoh. At least we got meager food, but we got it every day. And all we had were brick quotas. You know, that seemed doable in retrospect. And the wilderness, well, you know the wilderness drama. The wilderness drama is no bread, no water, no meat, no life support systems. And freedom didn't feel so hot. But you know how that works. They gripe a while. And then the bread came trickling down and they said, what is it? Because they wondered what it was. And they said, who wants to live on wonder bread? And they got quail. And they got water from rock. It turned out in ways they couldn't understand that there were life support systems in the wilderness that is governed by Yahweh and not by Pharaoh. What they discovered is that the wilderness of freedom, of covenantal freedom, is a place of abundance. Who knew? They didn't know till after they had gone there. They could not know ahead of time. And then they get two rules in the wilderness before they get to Sinai. The first rule is, don't hoard the bread. Don't act like Pharaoh. Don't turn the wilderness into another Egypt. Don't store it up. And the second rule is, keep Sabbath in the wilderness. I would have thought that life is so precarious in the wilderness that you had to be out there getting bread every day. No, No. It is a place for restfulness and provision is made on the sixth day so that you don't have to hustle on the seventh. There were no Sabbaths in Egypt. There was 24/7 cell phones, 24/7 computers. Andy's the only guy I know that turned the whole electronic system off for his sabbatical. Who knew? But not mostly. Mostly, if you don't hustle, you're going to fall behind. Mostly, if you don't get your kids to soccer practice and ballet, they won't get into the right kindergarten. Mostly, they won't get into the right school. Mostly, they won't get a bank job. Mostly, you got to stay at it. Mostly, if you don't grow your church, you're going to fall behind. Liberal churches know that because they're always going down to the street to your big churches, for God's sake. So you got to hustle. But in the zone where Yahweh is Lord, you don't have to hustle. You don't have to be on 24/7. You don't have to be productive. You don't have to meet quotas because loaves abound. And then they went to Sinai. And I guess you've noticed in chapter 19, before chapter 20 in the Decalogue, in chapter 19 they say, whatever you command us, we will do. They agreed before they knew what the commandments were, and I think they agreed to the commandments before they knew what they were, because whatever you're going to command us is going to be better than Pharaoh's commandments, because Pharaoh's commandments are make more bricks. Get back to your work, you lazy people. Jeb Bush says, American workers need to work harder. I don't know how many days it's been since Jeb Bush did that kind of hard work, or any of the rest of us of the ownership class. Because making bricks is hard work. So 10 rules for neighborliness. There were no neighbors in Egypt. There are only taskmasters and supervisors and slaves and competitors and rivals and threats. So this is the dawning. I know Hammurabi said it before, but we'll do this anyway. This is the dawning of neighborliness in human history. And I have only recently noticed that the word neighbor is not used in the Ten Commandments until the 10th commandment, and then it is used 3 times. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, patriarchal society. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or field. You shall not covet anything that is your neighbor. Because coveting precludes neighborliness. Cannot have it both ways. So here they were in 16:3. Whether to go or to return, whether to embrace the slavery and anxiety and fearfulness and greed of the predatory economy, or whether to risk neighborly abundance that you cannot know about ahead of time. We're not told the numbers. I imagine, well, I know some went on. That's our story. I imagine many of them went back to safety. Now, the reason that I want to talk about this text is that I think it is exactly a narrative of how faith is in a predatory culture. That we live in a predatory economy of extraction that extracts money from vulnerable people to give it to the already wealthy. That's the way the tax laws are written. That's the way the credit mortgage loan laws are written. Did you see the other day that Honda agreed? I love it. If you're big enough, you can agree with the court. You're not sentenced. You agree. They agreed to pay $24 million because they discovered that the loan program at Honda had been charging more interest to racial ethnic minorities. Who knew? There's something in the paper every day about the predatory economy whereby the big ones take another bite out of vulnerable. We live in an economy that has a voracious appetite for the military. We are now committed to perpetual war, and we have no exit strategy from anywhere, and we cover it over with all of our flag-waving U.S. exceptionalism. I'll bet you Pharaoh's flag waved the same way. Now, maybe that offends you, but that's all right. So we have this illusion of being the most noble, freedom-loving people in the world, and it is a cover-up for a predatory economy. So in the Episcopalian church where I worship, the rector will not have the flag, and there is endless restlessness about the flag. So I said to one of the really, really wealthy conservative women in our, what's a big deal about the flag? Oh, she says, it just makes Andy feel so good to wave the flag in church because he loves the illusion. Is it an overstatement, you think, to think that the totalism in our society now monopolizes our imagination so we can scarcely imagine outside of it? That the totalism now manages the media? The totalism now controls most universities through research programs? That the totalism has a major voice in the courts? That the totalism certainly thinks that the market should be totally unregulated so that the big ones can eat the little ones. And here we are, this little company of the emancipated who is committed to a gospel of neighborly alternative. Neighborly alternative that is local, that is artistic, that is subversive, that is relational. So let us entertain the thought about living on the precipice of 16-3 that most of us are quite double-minded. And the main evangelical task is to sort out our double-mindedness. So most of the liberals that walk alongside me are double-minded. Most of the conservatives I know in the church are double-minded. Most of us are double-minded because we have a stake in the predatory economy. But we know better. Now, all of this, I've been trying to read the book of Exodus. It's really very New Testament-ish. Jesus said twice, once in Matthew and once in Luke, you cannot serve God and mammon, capital, wealth. Puzzle about how to translate that. You cannot have it both ways. So the culture of greed destroys neighborliness. So we got a war on the poor. I'll tell you what I think. I think that which way we go as a national economy at this precipice depends upon the evangelical community. It depends upon the evangelical community doing social analysis and speaking truth about money. It depends on the evangelical community getting its mind off of safe subjects and walking into our own double-mindedness and deciding again. I don't know about you, but I got walking around in my body, and I've been tenured forever, longer than I can remember. I got walking around in my body the narrative of anxiety, scarcity, accumulation, monopoly, violence. And on a good day, I dance in emancipation. And then I arrive at the edge of abundance that is not yet in hand. And I get very nervous. So think what the ideology of scarcity does to us. The ideology of scarcity. It destroys neighborliness. And in the congregation where I worship, we got some really rich, old, conservative guys. I'm one of those three, old. So the word about scarcity in my church is there's not enough for whites anymore. Unless we take back our country. There's not enough for males anymore. Unless we take back our country. There's not enough anymore for white males. There's not enough anymore for the way it used to be when cheap labor stayed invisible. And we didn't worry about debts on vulnerable people. We're haunted by there's not enough. And then our haunting is interrupted by this incredible tale that loaves abound. They do. So that's my shtick.